Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Madina Thiam. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Mauro Nobili. Dr. Nobili is an assistant professor of history at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He is also the author of a brand new book, Sultan, Caliph, and the Renewer of the Faith, Ahmed Lobo, the Tariq al-Fattash, and the Making of an Islamic State in West Africa. The book just came out with Cambridge University Press in 2020, and I'm very excited to discuss it today with Dr. Nobili. Mauro, welcome on the show.
Thank you very much, Medina. Thank you for your invitation.
I was very happy to get a chance to talk about the book. And before we actually go on and do that, I'd like you to introduce yourself. Can you walk us through your background a little bit, the kind of historical work that you do and how you came to do that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for this. So I mean, I would start actually with a sort of more of a personal history of how I arrived to work on West Africa. And then I will take you to how I ended up working on this particular project, which is becoming basically almost synonym of my entire academic life so far. Because I've been interested in West Africa and glad to been able to travel to West Africa well before I became an academic. So I come from southern Italy, and I was born in a neighbor that was basically from the 1990s, the neighbors of West African migrants, you know, Senegalese, Malians, Burkinabe, Ghanaians, etc., in this city, in Naples, my hometown. So I kind of got attracted by West African community, the West African community, especially by West African history, well before I decided that this would have become my own, I would say, field of work. So, interested by the West African community, Muslim immigrant communities in southern Italy, I enrolled in an African studies program at the University of Napoli L'Orientale. And it is there that basically I did my entire education, all the way to my master and during my PhD. So the thing that attracted me the most was specifically how much Islam as a religion had shaped the lives of my, immigrants living with me in my area. So I realized that my interest in African studies laid specifically in the history of African Muslim societies. So I was glad to take Arabic. I studied Arabic Islamic studies and basically double majoring in African studies and Islamic studies. So when I went for my PhD, I decided that I wanted to work on Mali, and specifically that I wanted to work on Mali by reading Arabic manuscripts written by African Muslim scholars, specifically by Muslim scholars from Mali. So at the time, my attention was attracted on a very little known collection of manuscripts in Paris that is called the Fonds de Gironcourt, so the de Gironcourt collection that is housed today at Institut de France. So I was studying these 12 volumes of manuscripts from mainly Mali, Niger, and a little bit of Nigeria, when I basically my eyes were caught by a very strange little document. So the document was known, was written, was described as the Tariq al-Fattash. So it is a summary, this manuscript, of a chronicle that was, I mean, is very familiar, I would say, to every historian of West Africa, because it was published in a French translation in 1913 in Paris, by two very famous scholars of the colonial period, Octave Houdas and Maurice de la Fosse. So it has been widely used in his translations, despite substantial problems of authorship and authenticity. So, but there was a substantial problem, as I'm saying, with this document, because the text of the manuscript explicitly ascribed the chronicle to a character that never popped up in the extensive literature that was produced on the Tariq al-Fattash. So at the same time, I was kind of attracted by this thing, but also kind of puzzled, troubled. Honestly, at the time, I didn't really understand what was going on. I sensed that the manuscript was important. I translated in my dissertation as an appendix. I honestly just mentioned that this was an interesting manuscript that made little sense with our knowledge of the history of West Africa. And then I moved on. I mean, I thought I would have moved on because, in fact, the chronicle followed me in three continents, basically, and I continued working on it for a decade. Because I worked on it when I left Naples to move to the University of Hamburg, where I wrote like a little piece on a sort of newsletter of the center that was called of the Center for Manuscript Culture at the University of Hamburg. It was called the Manuscript of the Month. And then I moved to South Africa in Cape Town, where actually my book project, the one that I completed this year, started taking shape. So in Cape Town, I was a postdoctoral student at the Department of Religious Studies, as well as in the Timbuktu Manuscript Project that was led by Shamil Jeppi. And I would say that the time in Cape Town was by far the most formative period of my academic life. And as I like always to describe Shamil is a visionary. And the Timbuktu Project was basically the result of his vision of a Pan-African project bringing together scholars who were interested in Islamic literate culture from all over the continent. From, you know, of course, from Mali, from Senegal, from Ghana, from Niger, from Nigeria, from Mozambique, from Ethiopia, etc. And, you know, we are all working very close. And at a certain point in time, in fact, sharing like a big house in one of the neighbors of the of Cape Town, not that far from the University of Cape Town. So among the people that I was glad to meet during that time was the former director of the Ahmed Bada Institute of Timbuktu, with this major repository of manuscripts that was founded in the early 1970s and is now in split between Timbuktu and Bamako. So I met the former director, Abdul Kadri Maiga, was really the first person who gave to me access to the large collection of manuscripts of the center. And then also I got very close to now my good friend, Dr. Mohamed Jagayeti, who is the current director of the Ahmed Baba. You know, at the time, it was the summer of 2012. Dr. Jagayeti was involved in the famous, you know, smuggling of the Timbuktu manuscript from northern Mali, you know, during the time of the occupation of the cities by a series of jihadist groups. So I think that at that moment, so while in Cape Town, I had with me all the materials that I needed to start making sense of the complicated story of the Tariq al-Fattash. So I had this unusual manuscript from the de Gironcourt collection. I had several manuscripts from Timbuktu. I mean, digital copies, of course, of manuscripts from Timbuktu, but also guidance, of leading scholars about West Africa, but also leading scholars from West Africa and especially from Timbuktu. So basically, I think that all the pieces for me to work on the chronicle properly were now in place. But I think I should stop here because otherwise I'll be the only one talking. So please, Medina.
I mean, I could go on and listen to you. And it's so nice that you mentioned all of these colors and this house in Cape Town. I didn't know about it. It sounds great. Because it really shows also how, you know, the way your thinking comes to be shaped. It's really a collaborative process in a way. And I want to go back to the manuscript. I want to go back to the Tarikh al-Fatash because it is really the manuscript that grounds your book, that the book is centered around. And as you explain also, it is really a manuscript that has captured the attention of scholars for well over a century. So tell us a little bit more about it. What is this manuscript?
So the Tarikh al-Fatash. The Tarikh al-Fatash is a chronicle. It's a historical chronicle that, you know, it attracted the interest of Western scholars since the very beginning of the colonial period. So when the French entered Timbuktu in the late, 1893, and then eventually they maintained control of the city the year after, a French journalist, Félix Dubois, he arrived in Timbuktu to document for his French public the conquest of the city of Timbuktu. And he was attracted by the large amount of written materials that he found in the city. But he kept on hearing about a particular chronicle that he was really eventually interested in, but he couldn't find it, the Tarikh al-Fatash. So at the point that he describes the chronicle, you know, with a very often quoted statement as the phantom book of the Sudan. Now, the Tarikh al-Fatash will be soon published in France. So less than 20 years after Dubois visited Timbuktu, three copies specifically that were identified as different manuscripts of the Tarikh al-Fatash arrived in France. And as I mentioned before, these two scholars, Soudas and Delafosse, they started working together on an edition of the Arabic text as well as a translation into French. So basically in 1913, with this publication, for the first time scholars had at their disposal what they believed to be the Tarikh al-Fatash, which is what? It's a chronicle of Timbuktu and of West Africa more in general from a mythical period of time that is not really easy to locate and all the way to the end of the 1500s, of the end of the 16th century. And according to this narrative that was introduced originally by Houdas and Delafosse, the chronicle had been written by a jurist and a scholar whose name was Mahmoud Kati. And this Mahmoud Kati was supposed to have lived in the 1500s. But the chronicle, as we have it, was not, according to Houdas and Delafosse, the version of Mahmoud Kati, but was a chronicle that had been kind of updated by Mahmoud Kati's grandsons and eventually completed in the second half of the 17th century by his grandson that we know only as the son of Al-Mukhtar or Ibn al-Mukhtar in Arabic, who gave in a way the final shape of the chronicle. However, scholars almost immediately realized that the text that Houdas and Delafosse had reconstructed, although extremely historically important, was kind of a mess. So basically, since 1914 and all the way, I would say, until 2020 with my book, there's been several scholars who contributed to the historiography of this peculiar chronicle. I would say that almost all the scholars, the most important scholars from, worked on West Africa, have written some crucial piece of the story of the Fatash. I can think of John Anwick, of Medina Lital, Nehemia Lefzion, of Paolo de Moraes Farias, etc. However, I would say that none of the solutions to the problems of mainly authorship, so who was in fact author of the chronicle, and authenticity. So was the chronicle genuine? Were all those pieces written at the time in which they were supposed to be written or not? Are never really fully fixed, solved by the solution provided by these scholars. You know, I really, really like to cite all the time Medina Lital's comment. I would say a very personal comment in her contribution on the chronicle when she says, who does not feel discomfort while reading the chronicle despite, the critical apparatus of, provided by Houdas and Delafosse? So I kind of see myself in this long line of scholars who worked on the Tarikh al-Fatash. And that's why once in Cape Town, I think I had all the pieces together to contribute on the historiography of the Chronicle. Suddenly, you know, I felt like it was time to try to fix the history of the Chronicle, to remedy the discomfort that Medina Lital, you know, describes. It was actually shared by me and many other colleagues concerning the Chronicle. So at this time, I started working on the Tarikh al-Fattash with another of my colleagues and friends who was at the time already at the University of Johannesburg while I was in Cape Town, my colleague, Dr. Shahid Mafi. You know, maybe, you know, we were inspired by his amazing skills in making coffee, but I would say during several nights, you know, spent in his house, I think we really, really managed to start making sense of this Chronicle that had puzzled scholars, you know, for now almost more than 100 years, in fact. So we started comparing the manuscript from Timbuktu, the manuscripts from the De Gironco collection with the edition. And we realized that the complexity of the Chronicle itself was actually way more, you know, complicated than scholars had expected. So we argue in this article that we published in 2014 that the 1913 edition that everybody has been working on, is in fact not a critical, reliable critical edition of the Chronicle, but is a conflation of two different works, two different chronicles. One written in the 17th century and one written in the 19th century. So basically, what me and Shahid Mati argued in that article, that we are not facing with the Tarikh al-Fattash, with the edition of the Tarikh al-Fattash, an older work to which some forged passages had been added. We were actually dealing with two different chronicles altogether.
Right. And that's very important, I think, how you highlight the subtle but very important difference about the variety of arguments that scholars have made before about the Chronicle and the arguments that you made along with Shahid Mathi and also in your work about the Chronicles, plural. That is not merely a 17th century Chronicle that was modified in the 19th century, but it's actually a fully fledged 19th century chronicle that was added onto or merged with, and you can explain to us the details a little bit more, to that 17th century chronicle. And, you know, in the course of preparing this interview, we talked a little bit about actually how these two texts come together, the places where you see that they're not the same, the places where you see they're the same. And it was quite impressive seeing that, you know, side-to-side comparison of the texts. And so I would like you to explain to us a little bit more about, yeah, what is the crux of the argument you're making here about the nature of the chronicles? And why was it why is this important also? Why is it important to establish that this is a 19th century work that was added onto the 17th century work? I think this will allow to really understand what you're trying to do with the book, actually.
Thank you. Thank you for this, because especially you allow me to tackle one of, I think, the most complicated argument that I'm trying to make. Because I've already heard, for example, some people saying that their takeaway from my article with Shahid Mathi in 2014 is that we are arguing that nothing was written in the 17th century. This is actually not what we are arguing. So let me explain this point, because I think this is really, really the core of my argument. So, in order to do this, I need to get back to what scholars have been saying about the Tarikh al-Fattash and how scholars have been basically, you know, dealing with the Chronicle. So they believed in the existence of a 17th century Chronicle that is the kind of a pristine text that needs to be discovered and preserved, to which some parts were added in the 19th century. Indeed, I mean, it's obvious. The Chronicle makes explicit reference to the major character, one of the major characters of my book, was Ahmed Lobo, who was the founder of you know, the 19th century Caliphate of Hamdallah in what is today central Mali. So the scholarship, in a way, developed by trying to spot out what is original and what is not in the Chronicle, and to cleanse what is not original from the Chronicle. No, but I was not really, I've never been interested in the original chronicle. My brain has always been fascinated and attracted by the forgery, you know, the things that were done in the 19th century. And I mean, at the end of the day, you know, Mark Bloch says, you know, in his famous, you know, Historian's Graph, that we need to pay attention to forgeries because what is a forgery if not historical evidence? So attracted by this idea of seeing the story of the 19th century, of exploring the story of the 19th century, I focused extensively on what people have described as, you know, as forgeries. But in fact, first of all, I realized that the difference between the 19th century and the text that was produced in the 17th century was way larger than scholars have realized so far. So I basically realized that by reading the chronicle closely, we notice that the Tarikh al-Fattash cannot be simply described as a refashioned way of the chronicle from the 17th century. It is, in fact, a totally new chronicle written in the 19th century, whose author is referred to in that little manuscript from the De Gironco collection that basically opened this kind of Pandora box that led me to write the book. So Norman Tahir was a Fulani scholar who belonged to the entourage of Ahmed Lobo, the founder of Hamdallahi, but he wrote the chronicle and he ascribed it to the 16th century and to Mahmud Kati, the alleged author that we introduced earlier during our conversation. But again, that's very important, going back to your question. When I say that this is a new chronicle, I'm not saying that Norbon Tahir wrote the text from scratch. In fact, what Norbon Tahir did was using a pre-existing 17th century chronicle that was authored by Ibn al-Mukhtar, the grandson of Mahmud Kati. And basically, what he did is manipulating this older text by cutting, adding, replacing. So the point here is not just to understand how much in terms of quantity, you know, these two texts differ from each other. This is something that previous scholars have kind of already done, although I think they underestimated this difference. But what is very important is to understand the qualitative transformation that the chronicle went through. Because by changing parts of the chronicle, reshaping the older chronicle by adding, cutting, and replacing, the Tarikh al-Fattash is eventually a new project, which is characterized by a different authorial intention. And it is aiming to do a particular type of work on the ground, which is basically adding legitimacy to Ahmed Lobo and his newly founded Caliphate of Hamdallahi. And I mean, to be fair, Ahmed Lobo did need this kind of legitimacy insofar as he was basically a nobody in the political and in the religious landscape of central Mali in the first half of the 19th century. He was not a member of any of the noble warrior elite of the Fulani who were in charge of temporal power at the time, nor did he belong to any of the scholarly elite of Djenne or Timbuktu, for example, of the time. And, you know, I think it's really, really important for me to stress that we need to understand that these chronicles are not repositories of facts that were recorded by people who were actually almost taking pictures of the realities that they were living. These chronicles were political projects. And, you know, in this I'm really in depth immensely, I would say, to the work of Paulo de Moraes Farias, which shaped the way in which I'm understanding the chronicle. So as such, I think my book and my study of the Fattash, my approach to the Fattash, is not some kind of philology that is aiming at reconstructing a sort of, you know, in a Platonic way, the original chronicle. My intention is not specifically to understand what the chronicles say, but to try to understand the kind of work that the chronicle does in its own historical context. So I'm not trying to grasp the meaning of the text of the Fattash, but I'm trying to understand the type of work that the chronicle was meant to do on the ground. And at the same time, by exploring the chronicle and a series of documents that are sort of satellites around the chronicle, I'm trying to understand the world that the chronicle basically that called the Chronicle, you know, into being. And at the same time, that word the Chronicle itself wanted to impact upon. And by the way, just concluding, and then I pass the mic to you again, Medina. Even the title, even the title Tariq al-Fattash is not from the 17th century. It is a 19th century invention. Thank you.
So, that's super interesting. Actually, at this point, I was planning to ask you about your research process, and we will get there. But before we do that, I want to jump ahead and talk a little bit about this world, this 19th century world that the Tariq al-Fattash was born into. The Chronicle and its title, as you just mentioned. Tell us a little bit about that. What was this caliphate of Hamdulay, or this Dina of the Messina, as it is designated sometimes? What was this world that these people were trying to shape so much that they came up with this project of writing a new historical chronicle? What was going on? Set up the context for us a little bit.
Yeah, thank you, Dina. And also thank you for actually introducing the other ways in which this state was referred to. You know, I call it the Caliphate of Hamdulay from the name of the capital, but it is also locally known, actually locally is more known as the Dina or the Messina, the Empire of Messina, etc. So I stress the term caliphate because I want to underline that this state was a theocratic state. Just for us to locate it on a map, it was established in the first half of the 19th century in, I would say, the Middle Niger, roughly at the beginning, you know, from the beginning of the inland Delta Niger, southwest of, you know, the city of Jenne, for example. And it goes all the way to the Niger Bend, I would say, east of Timbuktu, but maybe not as far as Gao, the ancient capital of the the Songhai Empire. So why do I stress the term caliphate, the term theocracy, you know, in the place of maybe, you know, those that are more commonly used on the ground in Mali, especially the Dina that you mentioned before? Because what I'm using these terms to stress a major shift that occurs with Hamdulay in terms of understanding the sources of authority of the ruler. So in the case of Hamdulay, and contrary to what happened before, you know, when we had Fulani warrior elites and the Bambara warrior elite of Segu, in a way, occupying the space that eventually would become part of Hamdulay, who were, again, warrior elites and in which authority rested basically on lineage. So at the time of Hamdulay, authority got tied, became for the first time tied to Islamic knowledge. And I would say to Islamic sources of legitimacy. When I say knowledge, I mean both, I would say, empirical and mystical. So, you know, the kind of knowledge you can learn from the book, but also this kind of more experiential, mystic type of access to the divine mystery. Okay? But it was not just knowledge that became crucial in the construction of authority of Ahmed Dobbo. It felt at a certain point in time, that simply knowledge was not enough to justify the emergence of Ahmed Lobo as a new man in the West African landscape of the time. So the Tariq al-Fattash creates a further set of layers that strengthened the legitimacy of Ahmed Lobo. And here are the three words that I use in my title. So Ahmed Lobo is constructed in the Tariq al-Fattash as a sultan, that I use here as a synonym in a way of a temporal ruler, as the inheritor of a long line of kings that dates back to the Askia, the Sonni, the emperor of Mali, of Ghana, etc., etc. But Ahmed Lobo is also a caliph. So in a way, caliph here indicates more some kind of religiously sanctioned ruler. But in fact, not just the caliph, but a particular kind of caliph. So Ahmed Lobo is identified with an eschatological figure that is the 12th, so the last of the 12 caliphs mentioned by the Prophet Muhammad in one of the very famous hadith, in which basically it says that before the end of the world, there would have been 12 caliphs. So he's identified as this powerful eschatological figure, but it's also third element of my title, Ahmed Lobo is also identified as the renewer of the faith. But this also refers to a hadith of the Prophet, who is reported to have said that every century will witness the arrival of a person that is sent by God to revive the faith and prevent Islam from degenerating. So basically, the Tariq al-Fattash constructs claims for a ruler who represents a very new type of ruler in the West African landscape. Yeah, thank you.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So, Ahmed Lobo, indeed, you ascribe him this these three qualifiers, which are also the title of your book, Sultan, Caliph, and the Renewer of the Faith. And he is very important in the story, but actually he's kind of a secondary character in your book. The one character that really is center and front, and that I think you do really well, great job at introducing and explaining to us everything that he attempts to achieve in the region at the time, is obviously Alfano Hutahiru. So tell us more about who is the author of the so-called forgery and who ushers in that political project. So tell us more about him. Who is that character? What do we know about him? And how did you become more interesting in trying to lay out more about specifically his life and what he did in the caliphate?
Thank you. I mean, that's a complicated question to answer because Nuh Mundahir is clearly, the major actor in my book, along with Ahmed Lobo. But we don't really know that much about Nuh Mundahir, although he's very, very prominent in, for example, in the oral traditions of Hamdallah. The issue is that most of the information that are transmitted on Nuh Mundahir tend to be highly unreliable. So, for example, he has a very long lifespan. So if we take for granted the content of some of the oral tradition collected, for example, by Ampate Ba, who was, of course, a major scholar who contributed to the history of Hamdallah, Nuh Mundahir would have lived for 130 years or something like that, goes beyond, every optimistic, expectancy of life, especially in the 19th century. So there is a lot of issues that don't really make sense in the life of Nuh Mundahir. So what I try to do, I try to see through the works that he produced, because we do have some references to things that he wrote during his life, and through some of the documentation that makes reference to Nuh Mundahir. So what we basically can say with solid basis is that Nuh Mundahir was, a quite renowned scholar from the Middle Niger who joined the project of Ahmed Lobo, contrary to what believed before my book, quite early in at the beginning of the history of Hamdallah. And because of his stature as a renowned scholar, he basically became the second in command, the right hand of Ahmed Lobo. And he was the person who would be the closest advisor of Ahmed Lobo all the way until the death of Ahmed Lobo himself. He played a crucial role in the transition from Ahmed Lobo to his son. You can call him Ahmed II, so Ahmed, the son of Ahmed Lobo. And it's an interesting anecdote that I think can give you an idea of how important was Nuh Mundahir in the history of Hamdallah. Traditions say that Ahmed II felt unfit to replace his father as, you know, ruler of Hamdallahi. So he asked Nuh ibn Tayr to become the second caliph of Hamdallahi. But, you know, Nuh ibn Tayr, respecting the decision taken by Ahmed Lobo, on the contrary, endorsed the position of Ahmed Lobo, and he became, in a way, the tutor of the second caliph of Hamdallahi, only disappearing from the political history of Hamdallahi, political intellectual history of Hamdallahi, later on, at the time of the third caliph of Hamdallahi, Ahmed III. So Nuh ibn Tayr was a crucial intellectual from the Middle Niger. I mean, we know of him. He wrote a book on Arabic grammar. He wrote a book on, I would say, the history of the Prophet. He wrote several letters, because it feels like, you know, he has been in charge of the official correspondence of the state. And there was also a large amount of materials that he exchanged with the family, the very famous scholarly family of these teachers, the Kunda, who are based in Timbuktu and the desert area around Timbuktu. But, you know, when I want to mention Nuh ibn Tayr, of course, he is the real author of the Tariq al-Fattash, famous intellectual from the Middle Niger, student of one of the most important intellectuals of the time, and I would say most important, the closest advisor of Ahmed Lobo. Just for you to have an idea, you know, I have a picture in my book that has been graciously given to me by another friend and colleague, Mamadou Diallo, a picture of the mausoleum of Ahmed Lobo in Hamdallahi. So of course, it's a later mausoleum. It was not built at the time of Hamdallahi. But anyway, Ahmed Lobo is buried, in this area. And on his side is his son, Ahmed II. But there is a third character that is buried with Ahmed Lobo and his son in the same mausoleum. It is Nuh ibn Tayr. Yeah.
So a very important character for the caliphate, indeed. Yeah. So he's the author of the 19th century work. He's the one who writes it, as you said, to usher in a specific political project. So did it work? What he was trying to achieve by writing this chronicle, did he achieve it? Like, what work did the chronicle actually do at the moment at which it was produced in the region?
So what did the chronicle work? Well, I can answer in several ways. It worked if we basically see that his kind of trickery, his forgery, if you want to still stick to the term forgery, went basically unnoticed in its complexity until now. So at least he was very successful. Was it effective on the ground in terms of circulation? So were people aware of the claims of the Fattash? Absolutely, yes. So there is a very, very large amount of manuscripts on the ground in Malian collections that, cite parts of the Tariq al-Fattash. So the Tariq al-Fattash was very widespread on the ground. It's interesting because we have letters, we have pamphlets of propaganda, we have a fatwa, for example, who uses pieces of the Tariq al-Fattash. Then we have actually very few copies the Tariq al-Fattash itself. But in terms of, you know, being the claims of the chronicle known on the ground, we can say, yes, the chronicle was successful. Now, did it work in terms of providing legitimacy to Hamdallahi? This is a different story for several reasons. First of all, if I get, and I suspect so, the timeline of the production of the Tariq al-Fattash, the Chronicles was written very late in the life of Ahmed Lobo. And I'm sure, you know, we will have time to talk about this because it is related to diplomacy in the region. So I argue that the Chronicle will be written at the end of the life of Ahmed Lobo. So when the Chronicle was produced and started circulating, Ahmed Lobo basically reached almost the end of his career. So he dies. And although it feels the descendants of Ahmed Lobo, of course, had to hang to the chronicle as a way to legitimize the very foundation of Hamdallahi, the main character who is legitimized in the chronicle dies. Okay, so this in a way, makes the Tariq al-Fattash a project that arrived too late in the history of Ahmed Lobo. We don't really have any kind of explicit text that addresses the claims of the Tariq al-Fattash, with the exception of one. This is a fantastic, actually, letter that is written from a leading scholar from the Sokoto Caliphate, so from what is today's northern Nigeria, Abdul Qadir Dan Tafa. He has a response to one of the pamphlets of propaganda that were written by Nuh Buntair. And honestly, Abdul Qadir Dan Tafa from Sokoto destroys the claims of the Tariq al-Fattash, which is kind of interesting, you know, to understand the local approach to these issues at the time, is the ground on the basis of which Abdul Qadir Dan Tafa attacks the claims of the Fattash. Because all the Western scholars, starting from Dubois, always said, okay, the Tariq al-Fattash has some claims that were forged later on, because you cannot have a prophecy. So the core of the Tariq al-Fattash is a prophecy foretelling the arrival of Ahmed Lobo. So Abdul Qadir Dan Tafa does not question the possibility of a prophecy. But what he does, he questions the accuracy of quotation. So Abdul Qadir Dan Tafa questions that Nuh Buntair did not really understand very well the sources that he's citing. So as such, his argument is weak. I think this is very fascinating. Then there is also hints to some kind of other resistance to the claims of the Tariq al-Fattash in the sarcastic statement of a later scholar from the area of Timbuktu, from the Kunta family. It's a very famous scholar, Ahmed al-Bakkai, who kind of patronizes the Fulani in a completely different context. We're talking about, 15, 20 years after the death of Ahmed Lobo. See, that basically the Fulani are kind of gullible. They believe everything that they are told. And then I'm almost quoting, by memory, even they believe if somebody tells them that the 12th caliph mentioned by the prophet would have come from amongst them. Of course, this is a clear reference to the Tariq al-Fattash. So again, it's a complex response. How was it or not the Tariq al-Fattash, effective in shaping the world that he was trying to impact upon? Yeah.
Yeah, as you may imagine, I'm not very happy with the Fulani bashing going on in the response of Ahmed al-Bakkai. But something I wanted to ask you, for you to talk a little bit more about, is these diplomatic relations with the Sokoto Caliphate. You devote an entire chapter to them, laying out sort of, in trying to explain, the type of work that the Tariq al-Fattash was trying to achieve and whether or not it worked. And as you mentioned earlier, it's only to a certain extent, and it also gives rise to these exchanges among scholars from Hamdallah and the Sokoto Caliphate, in which they really do not mince their words at all in the way they're talking to each other. That was actually really great how you showed that in your primary sources. So tell us more about that, these diplomatic relations and scholarly relations between the Caliphate of Hamdallah and the Sokoto Caliphate.
Yeah, and indeed, this was, I would say, the chapter that I enjoyed writing the most. It came out quite easy, quite natural, because as you say, the sources are so, colorful, that you never stop, reading these things with joy. Anyway, so I really think that the diplomatic relationship between Hamdallah and Sokoto are fascinating for several reasons. So first of all, is this issue of the type of sources, very interesting materials, but also because we don't really know that much about pre-colonial intra-African diplomacy. So this is a very important case that goes beyond the topic of my book. It's sort of also an invitation to excavate more, the archives to see how these states were talking to each other. And this, of course, is also very important because the relationship between Sokoto and Hamdallah is extremely close, but very problematic. So we know that, Sokoto Caliphate is founded basically 14 years before Hamdallah. But Usman Dan Fodio, the founder of Sokoto, had showed interest in expanding, his movement to the West. So from what is today's northern Nigeria into what is, the Mali and Burkina Faso border, all the way to Timbuktu and to the area of Masina, where Hamdallah basically will eventually emerge. So he was actively seeking for, I would say, local proxy emirs who could start like a local dependent state in central Mali that would be in a way hierarchically subjected to Sokoto. And indeed, when Ahmed Lobo emerged as a leading scholar and also revolutionary leader in the region, he asked for permission, and I would say most likely also for support to conduct his rebellions against the Fulani of the Bambara in his region. But eventually, you know, when his messengers arrive in Sokoto, Usman Danfodio dies. There is some kind of quarrels between his brother and his son for, for the succession to as rulers of Sokoto. So basically, this thing delays a little bit Sokoto's intervention. And Ahmed Lobo actually manages to do the job by himself. So he gets rid of the Bambara of Segu, of the local Fulani warrior elite, and he establishes Hamdallah as an independent state from Sokoto. So from that moment on, there will be always an ambiguity. So the leading elite of Sokoto will see Hamdallah as a dependent state, while Hamdallah would always see itself as an independent state from Sokoto. So basically, there would be like a strong tension, you know, with peaks of tension in time that is really, really captured in the documentation that you, Medina, were referring to. But really, as you say, you know, there's sometimes very harsh words exchanged between the scholars, you know, kind of representative of the two factions. You know, I could cite some of the harsh words exchanged between these two elites, but just, you know, to kind of capture the way in which Ahmed Lobo used to, handle his quarrels. He was not a shy person. He was not a person who would keep quiet. I would like to mention, you know, another of his quarrels, not with the Sokoto leaders, but with the local Fulani, leader who lived east of the region of Hamdallahi. His name was Gelajo Ambodejo, who basically complains that Ahmed Lobo does not confirm him once his area is basically incorporated in Hamdallah, does not confirm him as a ruler of the region. And Ahmed Lobo basically writes to him saying that he understands power as rooted in piety and knowledge. Then he answered, as for your piety, it is questionable. Concerning your knowledge, is practically non-existent. Yeah.
Well, that quote was great, actually, when you inserted it in the book. And they're really writing to each other like that.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And just, you know, concluding a word on Sokoto, just to get back to something that I mentioned before, I think it was also extremely important for me to reconstruct this diplomatic relationship and the up and downs of this diplomatic relationship, because I think that we can date the Tariq al-Fattash is a 19th century product to the late 1830s through reading the correspondence between Sokoto and Hamdallah that reached a new peak at the end of the 1830s, when the first generation of Sokoto leader, who in a way had settled their dispute with Ahmed Lobo. So there's a new generation that comes to power and open again the problem of the dependency of Hamdallah from Sokoto.
Wow. Moving a little bit away from the content of the book, which I could talk to you about all day long, I was really curious reading this about your research process as well, like what the research process was like. Because as you just explained, I mean, obviously you have to, you know, working on the history of Hamdallah takes you to a lot of different other regions. As you track these manuscripts, as you have to figure out sort of the ramifications that the main manuscript, the Tariq al-Fattash, sort of had. So I'm really curious about your research process, and if you can tell us a little bit more about that. Where does one end up where they're trying to write the history of this manuscript and the history of the caliphate?
Oh, everywhere, literally. Because as you know, I started this research in France. And I must also say, you know, sometimes people manage, you know, to really plan their research very well. They know what they want to do. I had no idea. I mean, I found these documents and my research starts from a random finding. Okay. So intentionality behind the beginning of this research was zero. honestly. So I found this manuscript that opened the world. As I say, it opened the Pandora box. That basically took me, of course, to Mali through South Africa, but it took me basically everywhere in West Africa, because manuscripts that I used come from Senegal, from Nigeria, from Mauritania, from Niger. But I also conducted a failed mission looking for copies of the Tariq al-Fattash in Northern Ivory Coast and in Ghana. I was again with my colleague Dr. Jaget in Northern Ivory Coast in Ghana looking for copies of the Fattash. And basically that was like a very interesting trip looking for a manuscript described in two catalogs that we discovered were basically forged. So we have a forger in a forgery. So it's not just the Tariq al-Fattash that can be described as a forgery, but also two catalogs describing manuscripts from Ghana and Ivory Coast that listed copies of the Tariq al-Fattash we discovered being a forgery by themselves. You can write this little interesting article that I wrote and I co-authored with Mohamed Jaghete that talks about the story of the forged catalogs and the manuscripts that we couldn't find in Ivory Coast and Ghana. So, of course, the first stage was that of collecting together these materials. And then finally, you know, the story of the Fattash started looking a little bit like a puzzle, you know. So we had all these little pieces that I had to start putting together. And once, you know, I knew what was going on and I thought the process was basically done, I actually realized that I still had another substantial issue to face. So I was dealing with two stories, in fact, not with one, because I was dealing with the story of the Fattash, but it was also he's dealing with the history of the Philippine of Underline. That was really, really the toughest part of my work, was how to combine these two stories that are relatively, you know, different, also in terms of methodology, more of a philology, more of, you know, classical history, the second part of the story. So how could I tell these two separate but intertwined histories? Actually, was very complicated to figure out, and well, basically it took me 10 years to understand how to tell this story. Yeah.
Well, having read it, I can tell you that it fits very well together and it's all really fluid. It comes together really beautifully in the book, and I hope that everybody will read it, you know, in addition to listening to that to this interview, because it's done really well. Listen, I mean, we've taken up enough of your time already today, but before we fully conclude, I was just wondering what projects, small or big, it does not matter, you are currently working on and engaged on at the moment.
A lot of things. And I mean, also this kind of summer with the COVID-19 and no trips at the horizon, most likely will make some of these projects I'm working on, you know, see the light. So basically, I mean, I want to just focus on one particular project that is really related to the book that, you know, we discussed at length today. Because one of the things that made me uncomfortable was the fact that I did not provide in my analytical piece, in my book, Sultan, Caliph and Renewer of the Faith, I do not make available the 17th century chronicle by Ibn al-Mukhtar and the 19th century Tariq al-Fattash by Noah Bontair, but ascribed to Mahmoud Kati. I do not make them available for scholars, both, you know, for scholars to further develop my arguments or to, you know, contest my argument, but also, you know, for students who might actually be interested, you know, handling these chronicles in a more reliable way. So what I'm doing right now, I'm working on a project that has been generously sponsored by an NEH grant of an edition of a parallel compared edition and translation into English of the two 17th and 19th century texts. And, you know, I'm very grateful for the grant that I received from the NEH because it allowed me to bring on board two colleagues who are working with, you know, great enthusiasm with me on the project. So I have Ali Jakite from Hill Museum and Manuscript Library and Zachary Wright from Northwestern University in Qatar. And we are actually at quite advanced stage with the book, this new book that will have sort of introductory essay on the historiography of the Chronicle. And then we'll have the two Chronicles finally separated for people who want to, you know, read maybe only the 19th century or only the 17th century or want to compare the two texts. And also we will have chapters in which we'll basically reflect on which kind of stories the two texts finally separated can tell us about 17th and 19th century West Africa. And we've been already contracted by the British Academy, and the edition will be published by the Fontes Historia Africana series. Actually, in fact, we should deliver the book very soon. Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm sure these deadlines are facing you then, but that's really exciting. I think it will be a really great complement as well to your book. I mean, separately they stand fine, but it will be great to have both books together and be able to read them. And if I understood correctly, there's also a translation of this current book in the work, translation to French. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So this has been sponsored by my University of Illinois, because one of the things that really, really, really kind of leaves me disappointed is that not much of the scholarship that is produced in Europe and North America circulates in Mari unless it is in French. So what I did, I managed to secure funds to have my book translated into French. So it is now in the process of being translated into French, and it will be published in Mali by the Ahmed Baba Institute within their new series of publication. Actually, the Ahmed Baba Institute has been very, very active in publishing new editions of manuscripts that are hosted by the center itself. So this is a project, the way I like to see this project, that yes, I wrote it, but it is a project that mainly uses Malian archives that will be is being translated by a Malian translator, a professional translator, Seydou Traoré, and it will be published by a Malian institution, the Ahmed Baba Institute, hopefully to circulate with the Malian audience. Yeah.
Oh, that would be really fantastic also. And I can't wait to see how the work keeps blossoming, both here in the English-speaking world, but also in Mali, it will be really important. All right, well, this concludes our interview. Again, for our listeners, this was Dr. Mauro Nobili presenting his brand new book, Sultan, Caliph, and the Renewer of the Faith, Ahmed Lobo, the Tariq al-Fattash, and the Making of an Islamic State in West Africa, which was just published in 2020 with Cambridge University Press. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Mauro. I'm really excited about the book, and I hope that everybody who listened to this will go ahead and read it. It is really a fantastic read.
Thank you very much, Marina. That was actually lots of fun. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book. You know, there was a lot of my time and a lot of my enthusiasm behind it. So thank you really, really very much.